It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 526 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great conversation with writer Rob Williams, who is tackling the Mignola-verse with Mike Mignola in a series called Sword of Hyperborea. It's a further exploration of the world of Hellboy, and we get to see the sword through its various events in history, and this miniseries will be ending soon, so be sure to let your local shop know that you want this. We talk about who the characters are, how this comic came to be, and what we can expect from Rob in the future, so be sure to pick this comic up after you listen to this wonderful interview. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show! It's great to welcome to the podcast Rob Williams, a co-creator of sorts on the Sword of Hyperborea, which is also done by Mike Mignola, who's pretty popular around these parts. How you doing, Rob?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. And well done on saying Hyperborea probably correctly. We've just been talking about that off air. I think you got it right.
Let's hope so. I we need to have pronunciation guides in comics. I'm just sure of that.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to people's names. Your name and my name, people probably can get right, but other people, uh-uh.
Yeah, Mike Mignola, I've been putting the G in there, Mike Mignola, but who knows? It could be a silent G for all we know.
I think it's Mignola.
Okay, see,
but I don't know.
I messed up from the start.
Well, the thing that makes me laugh is I went to New York Comic Con, the last one that I was at, and there was a big booth that had a pretty big banner above it, and it said, Bilston Kev in big letters, itch on it. And I got a huge kick when I saw that because I didn't know how to pronounce that name before. I thought it was Sinkiewicz or something. I couldn't be sure.
So he's had a lot of experience of people getting it wrong.
Yes, I'm sure. So anyway, I was really glad to find out how to be sure to pronounce that. Now your experience in comics is quite diverse, is the term we like to use these days. Let's see, you've written for Marvel, you've written for DC, you've written for 2000 AD. It's easier to list the people that you haven't written for than the ones you have. And you're at Dark Horse, of course, the book we're talking about, which is part of the BPRD business. You guys are doing that, of course. That's a long time thing. Well, you've written Star Wars, too, haven't you, for Dark Horse when it was there?
Yeah, quite some time ago now. But, yeah, I wrote Star Wars Tales, and I wrote a book called Star Wars Rebellion for Dark Horse back in the Clone Wars, shall we say. Yeah.
Wow. So you get around.
That's
the good thing about that. So that's great. Let's talk about this book and about have you written? I'm looking through a list, but I don't see any other Mike Mignola stuff that you've been involved with. Is this your first one?
Yeah, it's my first sort of time playing in the sort of Hellboy verse or Mignola verse or whatever you want to call it. And it's a thrill because I've been a fan for quite some time and loved Hellboy and loved BPRD. I mean, I think I've read BPRD all the way through its run. To get a chance to contribute a little bit and hopefully not mess the place up too much is great. And I was working outside Sword of Hyperborea. I'm working with Lawrence Campbell, who's an amazing artist. And Lawrence, if people are BPRD fans, will know that Lawrence kind of drew BPRD for pretty much the last 5 years of its run. So he's the experienced hand here. He's helping me along the way.
So he can point out, well, that's not the way that this person looks.
Well, in all seriousness, I mean, I think Lawrence has got a very good feel for this world and he knows it very well. And then of course, the Hellboy editorial team were great and Mike was, we did a couple of Zoom calls and we kind of we sent notes and scripts back and forth, and Mike was very helpful in kind of pointing us in certain directions and kind of go, no, you don't want to do that. And and overarching kind of tonal points, you know, I think one of Mike's major things is like, you don't want to explain too much in this universe, you know. And right. I quite respond to that style of storytelling as well, you know, if you want to call it, I think of it as sort of Kubrickian, where you kind of, you know, it's better to tease people with mystery than it is to actually have a big info dump where you explain a lot of things and take a lot of magic away from it. I think one thing I'm learning with the Hellboy world is the fans are, you know, they like making their own theories as well. So it's fun.
Cool. Well, it's kind of interesting because one of the things I was going to ask was, how did you and Mike work together? And I think you kind of explained that somewhat because, you know, his name goes first, of course, because it is his universe.
Sure.
But I was just kind of curious how you worked. It sounds like that's how you did it. You kind of bounced things off of each other.
Yeah, it's very collaborative. I mean, basically, because Lawrence Campbell's done as the artist here, and he, you know, he's done a beautiful job drawing the book. It looks extraordinary. But, you know, Lawrence was in, you know, Lawrence and I would talk a lot of this stuff back and forth. And, you know, it was very much a, he was on board, and then he asked me if I'd be interested in coming on board as a writer. So Lawrence had certain things in place that he wanted to do. And then we talked to Mike and we bounced things around, and then Mike had a plot spine of kind of like what Gal Dennar, our main character in issue one, would do. And we kind of followed that and then built out from that. So you end up with something which is kind of like the sum of several heads, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because this is sort of a historical book. The way it's described, it says here that the sword, the iconic Hyperborean sword, has from the world of Hellboy has landed in many influential hands. This has been no accident. Trace the sword's path through the adventures and encounters that finally brought it to Ragnarok at the end of the world, and witness its influence at key points in history.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, the sword is, if people know, read BPRD, they'll know it's kind of almost like an Excalibur, like, you know, powerful weapon. If you look through the Hellboy history, which some people really look at sort of intensely, you'll see that it's appeared at various points. but there's large periods of history where no one knows where it went. And you know, for instance, it ends up in Sir Edward Grey in London at the end of the 19th century. The sword's there, and then the next time we find it, it's in Chicago, in a disused temple in Chicago at the, I guess, the late 20th century. So we were kind of, one of the things we talked about was like, well, how did it get there, and who held it along the way, and what was their story, and what were their adventures, and so it. Yeah, that was the kind of hook of the book, is just kind of like, okay, well, we know a couple of people who've held this sword along the way, but other people obviously did. It's thousands of years old. So if we could tell stories and introduce a few new characters and sort of broaden out the sort of the Hellboy universe a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the pop culture reference you put in the very first sequence. We see, I guess, is Gal Dennar, is that the name?
Yeah. Well, it's in modern day, it's Howard. It's a. This is where it gets slightly complicated. But there is a BPRD agent in our time, in modern day, called Howard, and he picked the sword up in this Chicago temple. And when he did, he was kind of possessed by the spirit of this thousand-year-old warrior called Gal Dennar, who also held the sword. So when we meet Howard at the start of issue one. It's modern day, but he's kind of a man of two worlds at that point. He's partly Howard's, and I guess you could say he's partly this thousand-year-old barbarian warrior too.
Well, I love the pop culture reference that you did. You know, she's talking to him, the girl that she's talking with. He's talking with, says, "I'm basically a superhero," and he goes, "What?" And she says, "Captain Caveman."
Yeah.
Which I had to laugh when I saw that. I thought that was funny. And he goes, "What did you just call me?"
Yeah, because I don't think he kind of goes, he's not too aware of Captain Caveman. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember Captain Caveman cartoons. And that's kind of who he is, really. He's that sort of Conan esque, you know, Robert E. Howard barbarian warrior who's going to smash things with his sword first and ask questions later. So I just thought it was, you're always looking to kind of drip little bits of humanity into these characters, you know, and make them feel a little bit three dimensional and real. And that scene when it takes place is quite a heavy scene. I mean, they know at that point, if you've read BPRD, that, you know, the battle against the monsters, against the Ogdruhem is, you know, they're losing, you know, it's like pretty much it's the end of the world. So just a little moment of light and a little moment of levity at the end of a world, I thought was quite a sweet little beat. That's what I was aiming for anyway.
I've always admired like Keith Giffen, who can do those kinds of things. I'll be in this dreadfully dire situation, and suddenly this humor thing will come and make me laugh out loud.
Yeah. I mean, Keith Giffen is, I mean, it's funny actually. I mean, someone posted on Twitter this week, but it's, I forget what it is, 35 or 40 years since Justice League One launched. And, you know, Giffen and I'll mispronounce his name, DeMatteis, are kind of two writers who had an influence on me growing up, definitely.
Oh, yeah, that was. I see them occasionally here in the States, and I always tell Kevin Maguire that he did the first selfie with the Justice
League. Kind of, yeah, I guess that's right. It's ahead of its time in a lot of
ways. Right.
But again, I mean, sort of, I always loved, I know Keith Giffen did the miniseries or preceded it, but the Dr. Fate series of that period that is one of my all-time favorite comic runs, and that had a big influence on my writing, I think, in as much that's a book that combined very heavy themes with quite grounded and undercutting humor that just humanized it all beautifully. And it's a great book that people should track down if they've never read it.
Great. So now let me ask you a question about the sword. Do you know how it got shaped the way it is?
Well, what shall I say here? I mean, one of the interesting things is that, like, when we talked to Mike McNaughton told us, you know, oh, this is pretty much what the sword is and where, you know, and this is how it works. And nothing I'm going to say here out loud, basically. But I think one of the really interesting things about the book and collaborating with Mike on it is, even as a fan's point of view, is you realize talking to him that he's got a lot more in his head, but he knows how this world works. And it's kind of, and he hasn't necessarily written it all down. And one of the things I love about it is, as he said, you don't want to explain too much of this stuff. So it's more sort of, you trickle out the mysteries and then you you let other people fill in the gaps, and it's kind of becomes all the richer for that, really. Mike would sort of, one of the fun things about this job was Mike would sort of go on a roll and something would spark him, and he'd go, oh, I always had this idea to do this kind of story. And, you know, Lawrence and I would be sat there kind of going, well, that's great, why don't you do it? And he'd go, no. I'm retired now. And then you kind of go, but then he can't help himself. He still kind of, he's got a lot more stories he seems to have there just waiting to tell. And, but it's one of the great things is, like, that sword, it looks so unique. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about, you know, Mike's work over in this world is we've all seen so many fantasy epics, and Mike can still create something which is distinctive and sticks with you.
Because it's split at the top.
Yeah. Which is something we lean into thematically in the book as well. I like that kind of how it suggests a path that can go in two different directions, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I enjoy is the action also that are in the books. There's this great big tall guy with a necklace with the teeth on them.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting into a fight, and I got a huge kick out of that. Not everybody plays clean, shall we say, in all this. And I always get a kick about the way it does that. And that fight was kind of a fun thing for me to watch. You know, you've got the girls are dancing around the fire, and before long, let's just say that somebody says something that he don't like, and it starts off, and it doesn't take much to get some of these people fighting. I found it interesting.
No, it's very similar to where I grew up. Although we wore more clothes. No, it's a big bonfire, and it's a tribal battle. You know, that's a battle to the death. And Gal'Dinar is kind of, in Hyperborean times, thousands of years ago, in that scene, that's a challenge. You know, he's head of the tribe, and this guy challenges him. And so, you know, it's a punch and knocking you down is not going to do it. You know, someone's got to, someone's blood's got to get spilled, you know. And that was great. I mean, that was a chance. There's many chances in this book, in this series, as a writer, for me to just get out of Lawrence's way, really, because he draws sequences, yeah, like that so beautifully. And it's just, well, let's keep the dialogue to a minimum and just let the art speak for itself, which is, you know, I think a smart thing for a writer to do sometimes. If you know you're working with someone who can absolutely make this stuff sing. And, you know, one of the things in issue one, we wanted it to have this epic barbarian quest feel, you know. So when, after the fight, Galdenar goes searching for the mythic warriors who gave power to the sword, you know, we wanted that journey to feel like it takes years. It's not him just popping down the shops, you know what I mean? It's just like, that's a... We wanted the book to feel like it meant something and sort of hit him. Yes, hit him in the guts, and that, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
There's a wonderful sequence where he is talking to what looks like a wolf god. Yeah. And he pronounces my name, and he says to him, I don't know. Should I spoil this? I guess the book's been out a while. I can say that. He says to Galdenar, he says, "You are not the sword. Do you understand?" And his response is, "No."
Yes.
Which I found interesting because I thought that was really... And then he says the word Chicago. Yeah. And he goes, "I see." And I thought, that is a precise conversation.
Yeah. And it's kind of... It's I think from... In this kind of cryptic world, if you know, I love that sequence. And it's meant to feel magical. And I think if you're trying to portray a magical sequence like that, where you're speaking to some kind of spirit, which is not human... You know, people aren't going to explain things definitely. Well, here's what you need to do, okay, pal? You know what I mean? It's just, it's a kind of trying, it's a communion between two different kind of intelligences there. And as we see, Galdenar has taken some kind of hallucinogenic sort of drink at that point as well, which helps bring it on. But he when he's told, you know, that, I go, without giving too much away, but Wolf says to him, you know, "You are not the sword." The wolf is trying to tell him something there, and he doesn't get it. He's going, "I don't understand." And then, but then the wolf says Chicago, and this is the thing. We kind of know that the sword will end up in Chicago. We've seen that already. There is a kind of time loop type of deal to it all, I suppose. And then he goes, "Oh, right, okay, I get it." But we don't actually say exactly what he gets. But I think Galdenar, he does understand something at that point. He understands something of his role in this. To me as well, I loved that moment of, this is thousands of years ago, you know, the land masses haven't shifted, you know, America has not remotely been created, and to have to have this sort of spirit say the word Chicago thousands of years ago just felt really kind of magical to me, you know.
Different.
Yeah, it sort of says, like, as I say, there is a purpose to what's going on here, you know, and
So one of the great things about this book, too, is that you get to deal in monsters. Mm. And towards the end, we get to see a very different monster, which I won't get into. But you talk about Lawrence and his ability to do all these things. We get to see a variety of different monsters in it. And I guess from a writer's standpoint, you just get to say, monster so-and-so does this, and then it's up to Lawrence to kind of make that happen. Mm. But you get the, you know, are you referring to a lot of the BPRD past stories and stuff like that when the monsters come around?
Yeah. And there has been several Galdenar Hyperborean stories before in the pages of BPRD, which James Harren drew absolutely beautifully. So, you know, reread those, you know, some of the stuff, you know, a fair few things actually is referenced back to those. So you're picking up certain, you're picking up that world, things that have already been established in that world. It's kind of, and from Lawrence's point of view as well, some of that stuff has been designed. I mean, we several decades in now, this is a well-established universe in a lot of different ways, you know, and we're very fortunate that some of the people who've established this stuff visually are some of the most amazing artists who you know, comics has had in the last couple of decades. People like Guy Davis and Duncan Fogredo and James Harren, you know. So, and, you know, and Mike himself, of course, you know, who is, it's his universe and in terms of look and feel. So, yeah, it's everything. There's a lot of things there where, you know, they've already been designed for you and they already look absolutely very distinctive in that way, yeah, that stick with you.
That makes me ask a question, though, as a writer. In a story like this where you're kind of connecting the dots, is that easier or is it harder? Do you have to kind of – you have to go with established things and make them connect, or is it easier because you've got – you know where you have to go, it's easier to get there. How did that work for you as a writer?
It's kind of – well, it's both. It's kind of it's hard in as much that you don't want to make a mistake that something that sort of contradicts things that have gone before. You don't want to tonally step out of a universe. You don't want to mess it up because, like you say, the standard of quality, I think, in this world has been extraordinarily high. It's easier in as much that I think writers always – like I can't speak for anyone else, but writers – often I look for structure. We need structure in some form because otherwise there are infinite choices and you will just melt down and you won't get anything achieved. So that's why we need structure in our work. And I think when you have something like this where there is an existing universe, there is existing points in the historical map that have already been hit, you go, oh, okay, well, I know the sword ends up there and I know it ends up there. So I've got – it gives me a spine to work to, and then I can go off and do whatever I want, you know, and that's my part in it, to try and do interesting new things with this and introduce you to brand new characters in issues 2, 3, and 4 that hopefully people will respond to. And we're telling new stories in this world. And but you know where you have to come – you've got 2 points in the map to hit, and it's – I think it's a metaphor that, like someone said about writing in general, is a bit like trying to drive across America at night or something. It would be overwhelming, you know, with no lights on. You would go, there's too many places I could go. I'm never going to make it where I need to go from one coast to the other. But if you kind of have I've got to go to this town tonight, and then the night after I've got to go to this town, and the night after that I've got to go to this town, then you'll do it. You'll make it, you know, across – yeah, the huge continental landmass, but you need targets you can see and hit in front of you, and a lot of the things that have gone before in the Hellboy world actually provided that structure in this book for us.
Because it's funny, because when some people drive, they don't want to know where they're going; they just sort of meander.
Yeah, and that can work too. And I think there's everyone's different, right? It's just I've written. I think we all write both ways. Sometimes something hits you and you go, oh, I'm going to head off in totally new track. But I think you need to have an idea of where you're going. Otherwise, you could easily find yourself lost along the way.
See, I prefer the latter, the one you're just talking about, because I can tell sometimes when somebody is writing and they know where they're going, and I can trust them to know that we'll get someplace really good.
Yeah.
I like that. I think your writing, too, does a good job of that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like part of it is – I think about this a lot with writers who I like. And it's kind of you feel you trust them, I think, because they have an authorial tone, which basically says, look, you're in safe hands here. And I think we respond to that as readers. We want to feel like we're along for the ride with someone who knows what they're doing and not someone who's just winging it. Because, I mean, you could have a crazy thrill-packed ride if someone's winging it, but also you can easily crash into the wall. I've taken this metaphor way too far.
Well, that's good. That's kind of fun to see. I wanted to tell you, one of the things I really enjoyed was the last few panels of the first book. Right. I forgot that this was a mini series, and I had to go back and look and say, oh, is this a mini series? That can't be the end. Oh no. Oh my gosh. And I'm not going to spoil it because I want people to read it. There's something really great. I thought happens, and it just flummoxed me. I said, there's got to be more. And luckily, I was thank goodness it's a mini series. That means that issue two, which should be out around the time of this post. So that'll be a lot more fun to see where how you picked it up. Are you going to pick it up right from that point? Or are you going to move forward or backward in the timeline?
How well, are you we're kind of moving through timelines. So, yeah. But I mean, you know, I came up right in through 2000 AD, and 2000 AD is built on like almost like the structure of those old Republic serials where the cliffhangers have to be big, right? And, you know, mm-hmm. you've got to get people back next week or next month or next issue. So, there is a lot of that in as we move forward. But it's, we've got a four-issue miniseries, and then we will be following the sword through the timeline. So you might not get a direct resolution of what happens at the end of issue one, per se.
Okay.
Without spoilers.
Okay, well, that's good. So the way you phrased that made me wonder if you didn't have more story ideas for the sword after this miniseries.
And we've been talking about it, and I think we'll see where we go. I mean, one of the exciting things about this book for Lawrence and I is issues. As I said, issue one follows Gal Dennar, and he's an established character. We've seen him before in BPRD. Issue two and three and four are brand new protagonists, brand new characters. But we've come up with in talking with Mike and with the Hellboy team, and so there, there's plenty of places that these characters could go that we're introducing you to, and we're kind of teasing a bunch of different things with them as well. We shall see. I mean, if people, as ever with this type of thing, I mean, if people respond to them and like them as much as we do, then hopefully we'll see more of them. But we've got to introduce them to the world first.
Are they going to collect this after the miniseries is done?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a trade of it coming. Yeah,
that'd be good, because when I go to stores and I look into the Dark Horse section, there's usually a big Mignola section.
Yeah.
BPRD is a big section, and Hellboy's got its own big section. So you're adding to that mythology, and I think that's a great thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and I think it's – there is – like I said earlier, I mean, even in chats with our brief chats with Mike, when he kind of comes up with ideas and things, you could do that if you want. And we kind of – there are many more, even though, if you read Hellboy through its run, Hellboy's story is done, really. But, Mike just came up with an Edward Gray book, and there are, it's a really rich, wide universe that he's created that goes back over thousands of years and beyond that even, and into the future. So there's all kinds of stories still to tell there, I think.
I was interested, too, that there's no subhead titles for apparently these books and stuff. Was that intentional?
I can't say so, really. I mean, it was, Sword of Hyperborea was the title we came up with. I mean, we're following the sword. It's just it's a cool title, but there was no, it's not a BPRD book as such, or a Hellboy book. I think it says something like from the Hellboy universe on the covers. That's it. We're in that world, and you will see characters. If you're a fan, you will see characters from the past. You might recognize popping up as well, but also there's brand new characters interacting with them.
So basically, you've got this miniseries in the bank now, right?
Yeah, we're done with it. Yeah.
Wow. So now you're just waiting to see what happens. How the fans react to it.
Yeah. Well, issue one, I mean, seems to have gone down really well, and which is really nice, and. It seems to have sparked a bunch of theories amongst the sort of Hellboy faithful as well, which is kind of fun. So yeah, we just got to like anything like this. Now we've just got to nail the landing, really.
Well, that makes me want to ask something. How do you keep track of what the fans think of it? Do you go online and read like message boards and stuff, or are there fan clubs that kind of have websites that you go to see what's going on? Or because some people avoid that like the plague because they're afraid that if you read something on there and then you use that idea, then they're going to say, hey, you used my idea.
I try I'm a bit of both these days. I'm way better at trying to avoid it and not reading reviews because I just think no good could come of that. I don't know. I mean, I actually, even before this call, Lawrence Campbell dropped me a line. He went, "Oh, you should listen to this Hellboy Universe podcast. They're talking about it and they've got lots of theories." So, yeah, which is great, but it's kind of sparking that kind of feeling. But you have to be careful. I think you don't want to kind of take good reviews to heart. You don't want to take bad reviews to heart. At the end of the day, you've just got to try and tell what stories, the story you want to tell, really, and not let any of that affect you.
That's interesting because there was an actor on a TV show. I was at a convention and they were asking him, "What do you think when you see what the fans say?" He says, "I never look at what the fans say." He says that would influence what I'm doing, and I don't want that. I want to do what I want to do.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous as well because I mean, even if you did try and please, I don't think you. I don't know. Maybe some people can, but I can't do that. At the end of the day, I just you've got to follow your own path, right? And obviously you would love people to like you. No one wants bad reviews, but you just kind of. I've been, like you said at the start of the conversation, I've been working in comics now for 20 years and I've had lots of good reviews and I've had lots of bad reviews. So it's just like the truth is somewhere in the middle usually.
Well, that's great because now by the time this post, issue 2 is either out or just about to come out. So I expect the rest of them to be monthly and then probably a couple months after that we'll get to the trade paperback.
Yeah, that's right. I think February the 16th, if I remember right, issue 2 is out. And we meet there. We there's an opening sequence I won't talk about. And then after that point, we meet a brand new character called Grafling de Gotha. She's a German spy at the start of World War I in Belgium. And she gets given a mission because there's talk of a cult undergoing strange experiments in a house somewhere in the woods, and she has to track them down.
It's interesting to me because, you know, I think great writers can write in all kinds of genres. And I've read your Suicide Squad, among others, and, you know, and this was a great read, too. Is there a genre you prefer, or is it good for you to stretch different muscles different times and do different kinds of writing?
It's good to... You don't want to be just do one thing. I mean, I think my natural kind of fallback sort of tone is fairly comedic, which is not what this is really. Which is like I think what my there was a lot of that in my Suicide Squad. It wasn't all my Suicide Squad was. I'd like to think there was a lot of drama and action and sort of quite some dark stuff in there as well. But it was a lot of fun. It was, to me, more than anything, it was like a fun comic to read, you know. I think sort of if you go into sort of a horror and the sort of a creepiness and whatever of the Hellboy world, you know, as we said earlier, you know, with the Captain Caveman line, there's always a place for a good comedic line. And if you read Hellboy over the years, you know, Hellboy's really, it's a really funny comic at times, you know what I mean, in spite of all the other things that go on in there. But no, I think it's healthy to kind of to stretch yourself. And for instance, you know, we go from issue 1, you know, about Robert E. Howard style, quite sparsely dialogued barbarian adventure, and suddenly issue 2, where quite well educated German noblewoman's our narrator, and suddenly you have to write her interior monologue, and that's an entirely different voice, you know. And then when we go to issue 3, you're going to meet a quite hedonistic, arrogant, Swedish deep sea diver who's got a problem with alcohol, you know. And again, it's that's what that's what you respond to as a writer is different. You know, trying to tell stories with different characters with different voices in different worlds, you know. That's part of what we do.
That keeps us, as readers, it keeps us guessing too, which is always great. If somebody goes too easily, you know, if you have I've always talked to writers and they always tell me, if you end with a cliffhanger, don't resolve it immediately.
Yeah.
take a little while and do some other storytelling and then get to that, because that's what they want. People are going to go, and that you get the chance to develop other story along the way before you get to that. And they know you're going to get there.
Yeah. And you, I mean, as a writer, part of what you're doing is trying to, you're trying to lead the readers down certain paths, and then you kind of go, but it's that control thing of kind of go, if you're doing it right, and if you've nailed what you're doing, you kind of go, right, you want this now, don't you, reader? Well, I'm not giving you this at this point. I'm giving you something else. I'm going to make you wait for that. And it's kind of, it's very similar to me feeding my dog. I just realized.
Oh, goodness.
Which is more insulting than I mean it. But I think there is that thing. You want to, like I said earlier, you want to be in the control of someone who like, I've got complete control over this story. Right, you like this character? I've made you really like this character. Right, now I'm going to kill this character. You know, you're like, no! You know, and
that's right.
This is, you know, this is what good writers do.
Surprises.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than being surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because I have seen so many things that I can sit there. I used to watch television way back when, and they would always do very predictable stories. And I would watch some of, because I used to watch the show called Heart to Heart, because they had a happily married couple, which I like to see. But the story was so predictable. I could turn on the first two or three minutes and see what it was. And I said, okay, I know how this is going to end. And I'd come back at the very end of the episode, and I see, sure enough, there was the end that I expected.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
But it's kind of like, I mean, writers are cruel, right, if they're doing their job properly. I was watching, spoilers on this, I watched an episode of a show called Yellow Jackets last night. And there was a character, it's a plane crash, and there's survivors of a plane crash, and they've got this, one of the kids has got, there's this old prop plane, and she goes, I'm going to fly this out. I know where this is going. This is all going to be, the writer here is giving us the heroic beat, but she's going to make it, and then she doesn't make it. I can predict it a mile off. And that, and so it proved. But then what the writer did was, because she's a kid trying to do this heroic thing, she put her teddy bear in the passenger seat of the plane. I went, I was just thinking, whoever that writer is, you are a cruel person. Now I really care. Now I'm really invested. And it was all because of the teddy bear. And I just thought that was a nice bit of writing and what could have otherwise been quite a predictable little thing. So and it was a cruel bit of writing. So I think writers are often very, they're being cruel to their audiences. They're making you feel things you don't necessarily want to feel.
And I always say that you know, you hate your own characters because you have to do terrible things to them.
Yeah. Because if you know, if you like, I mean, I've done that in the past when I did Suicide Squad. I mean, it was just, there was one character, I won't say the name, just in case anyone reads my Suicide Squad run, that's going, I really like this character now. And then you almost feel like, well, because I really like them, I like the thing the audience probably does too, so now it's probably time to get rid of them and kill them off. So that's part of the job, I think.
I got to read more of your writing. I'm just convinced of that.
Oh, thank you.
So let's, speaking of which, are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
I've got a World War II horror book, creator-owned called Out, which is in the shops right now. And that's via AWA Studios, and that's with Will Conrad. And that's I think we've had issue 4 out. We've got issue 5 still to come in about a month's time, a few weeks' time.
Wow.
And then the trade paperback for that is out in March. And the general hook of that is basically it's the Great Escape, but there's a vampire in the camp with the prisoners of war. So so they had to try and escape anyway, but now they're being picked off one by one. And it's the type of comic that if, you know, if you enjoy John Carpenter's The Thing and Ridley Scott's Alien, you know, you'll probably get a kick out of it.
Good. Sounds like I'll have to get that one. I missed the first couple, obviously. I'll have to get the trade when it comes.
Yeah. So I think that's the end of March, I think the trade's out.
Okay, I'll keep my eye out for it because I really want to get that kind of stuff because I really enjoy that. So, well, it's been great talking with you, Robin, and I hope you get to write a lot more stuff because I love the way you think about all this stuff. I think it'll be wonderful to get more stories along those lines.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, really nice to talk to you. And but like I say, if people want to find me online, I'm on Twitter at RobWilliams71, and I'm on Instagram at RobWilliams1971, and you can usually find it updates on my work there.
No Facebook?
I am on Facebook, but I wouldn't know how to tell you how to get there. There's so many Rob Williamses. I have a common name, unfortunately.
That's true. Okay. Well, keep up the wonderful stuff, because I'm going to get more of your stuff moving forward.
All right. Thanks a lot. Really nice to talk to you today.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.